First, a warning. I intend to use the word superpower this morning as if it actually meant something, so bear with me. The prefix super does have meaningful applications, as in the term superheated, which usually refers to water that is heated under pressure to temperatures well beyond the boiling point without having turned to steam. The water inside American-style nuclear power plants is superheated. Even Super Bowl refers unambiguously to the final championship, the one after the regular season and the playoffs, like the Stanley Cup and the World Series. But some other uses are on shaky ground, like superstar and superhero. Time was when a superstar might be a sport figure who earned more than $1 million in a season. But inflation has ruined the value of the dollar, and multi-million-dollar contracts have become so common that the term superstar is rendered effectively meaningless. When the average player in the league is a superstar, then everyone is, or no one. Comic book fans will argue that Batman and the Hulk are real superheroes compared to Ulysses and Gilgamesh. But with your indulgence, I propose to bypass that debate for another day. Suffice it here to say that the term superpower is borderline gibberish, sort of like the empty calories in a cup of white sugar. Still, relying heavily on intuition and the willingness of practically everyone else to play the same game, we agree loosely that the Soviet Union was a superpower, was, but that Russia isn't. We look at China's market and military, at its giant industrial capacity, its imports and exports, its dollar holdings, and its Olympic team, and we declare that it is, or is soon to become, a superpower. We say this with a straight face and in tones that imply it will be a big day for China when they finally make it. Really big. 2 years ago, the U.S. had unloaded shock and awe on Baghdad and brought the war to a speedy, not to say optimistically premature, conclusion. The mission was accomplished. Reconstruction, as it was then called, was not yet blamed for having failed to deliver electricity, clean water, or even oil on a predictable basis. The insurgency didn't even hint at growing to a point where it would influence international gasoline prices, hamstring internal Iraqi political processes, or account for as many deaths in a day as required a week or even two in those days. Everyone, including the president, whose public speech is heavily laced with such linguistic junk food, called the U.S. the world's only superpower. People all across the political spectrum asked what country was next on America's hit list, as if nothing could prevail over U.S. military might. It was a delusion, but it was, in those days, a very common delusion. As time went by, Washington's difficulties in Iraq hastened the awareness that Washington could be opposed effectively without incurring unacceptable costs. In an analysis of the new balance of power, Michael Weinstein and Yevgeny Bendersky of the Power and Interest News Report conclude that U.S. intervention in Iraq has, quote, revealed the limits of Washington's ability to implement its security strategy of becoming the unquestioned political and military arbiter of the globalizing world economy, end quote. Call it what you will, American superpower, primacy, dominance, supremacy, unilateralism, or empire, what are the options? Probably the simplest and most elegant vision has been put forward by M.K. Bhadrakumar, who was a career diplomat in the Indian Foreign Service for more than 29 years. He believes a three-way relationship among the U.S., EU, and China would provide a significant alternative to global domination by a single power. Bhadrakumar's three-part international architecture would be similar to the U.S.-China-USSR relationships of the Cold War era, when any two pillars of the triangle could together trump the third. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, offers a more erudite analysis by finessing the superpower jargon, speaking instead of geopolitical players and pivots. Players are states that have the ability and the will to exercise power and influence beyond their borders, to seek global standing or regional dominance. They may be motivated by the quest for national grandeur, ideological fulfillment, religious messianism, or economic aggrandizement. Some states do seek to attain regional domination or global standing. Brzezinski identifies France, Germany, Russia, China, and India as players in this sense. While Great Britain, Japan, and Indonesia are admittedly very important countries, for reasons which he details, Brzezinski does not consider them players. Pivots are states whose importance is derived not from their power and motivation, but rather from their sensitive location and from the consequences of their potentially vulnerable condition for the behavior of geostrategic players. For example, South Korea is a far eastern geopolitical pivot. Its close links to the United States enable America to shield Japan and thereby to keep Japan from becoming an independent and major military power without an overbearing American presence within Japan itself. Any significant change in South Korea's status, either through unification and or through a shift into an expanding Chinese sphere of influence, would necessarily alter dramatically America's role in the Far East, thus altering Japan's as well. Samuel Huntington, the Harvard political scientist who invented the phrase clash of civilizations, argues that the American empire is a myth because the U.S. does not generally exercise direct rule over other countries. But he does describe the United States as the only superpower with overwhelming dominance in virtually every category of power, whether it's military, economic, technological, cultural, diplomatic, or what have you, what Stan Goff calls full-spectrum dominance. In a grand academic uglification of language, Huntington declares that the structure of global politics is basically a uni-multipolar world. The United States cannot dictate what goes on all by itself, he says. It needs the cooperation of some of these major regional powers to accomplish anything in world affairs. To Brzezinski's list, Huntington adds Brazil, Israel, Iran, Indonesia, and, quote, probably South Africa. But on the other hand, the United States, as the only superpower, is generally able to veto international actions proposed by any coalition of these other major actors, end quote. John Bolton's sabotage of the big Millennium Plus Five summit in New York a couple of weeks ago is a good example of U.S. ability to veto international actions unilaterally. But even that didn't mean that the U.S. was above effective opposition. Behind the scenes at the MDG Plus 5 summit, Bush's aides were scrambling to put out a fire. Countries that Bush considers partners, China, Russia, and India, were banding together to stymie a U.S. and European effort to bring sanctions against Iran for its suspected nuclear weapons program. The Iranian case has created another unlikely partnership of the moment, India and Pakistan. Both spent decades building secret nuclear arsenals which they aimed at each other, but now Pakistan and India both oppose any effort to penalize Iran. Writing for the New York Times, David Sanger offers the opinion that, quote, no one seems to think that this sudden agreement between Pakistan and India reduces their rivalry. But to many in the Bush administration, it is stunning. They are surprised that Pakistan, which Bush declared a major non-NATO ally, and India, which just struck a deal with Washington on cooperation in civilian nuclear technology, are working together to oppose one of Bush's most urgent counterproliferation goals. End quote. According to Sanger, The South Koreans and Chinese are also living with at least the idea of a nuclear North Korea, and they want it to be stable. Their concern is that unilateral action by the U.S. to bring about regime change in North Korea might result in millions of angry, hungry refugees flooding across their borders. Could this mark the beginning of the end of the U.S.-South Korean alliance? Sanger asks. In two recent speeches, President Roh Moo-hyun of South Korea talked openly about a new role for his country, one far less dependent on the United States. South Korea, he said, would play a balancing role in the region. That's it for this Monday. If you would like to suggest a story or comment about anything you hear on Monday Morning World Report, email Earthling, that's EARTHLING, at netidea.com. Put Monday Morning World Report in the subject line to make sure I don't mistake your message for spam. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.